ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, my name is Nij, and I host Imagine This, a science podcast for curious kids and their grown-ups about the questions you've probably always pondered but never actually known the whole answer to. Like, how do magnets push and pull? Why is dew on everything in the morning? And how does sunscreen actually work? Find Imagine This on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. The Christmas party invitation says smart casual, but what does that actually mean when it is 35 degrees outside and storms are on the way? And is formal attire different in Melbourne than in Brizzy? In the next 20 minutes, I'd love to know how you decipher dress codes in 2025 and whether the city you live in is a factor. Also ahead, after two major brands were called out for using artificial intelligence in advertising campaigns, some labels are now spruiking themselves as human-made. But if it's just an ad, why do we care if AI is involved or not? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, summer holidays are on the horizon, and if you're anything like me, you have stacked your schedule with a lot of time in the great outdoors. I am personally hoping to squeeze in at least one overnight hike, maybe an outdoor climbing expedition. If I'm really lucky, maybe a day or two out on the water in my kayak. But one thing that should be on your radar and mine is worst case scenarios in adventures like these. It's not something you want to dwell on, but preparing for all possibilities can literally be the difference between life, death, or being extracted by a specialist rescue team. So how prepared are you to venture into the wilderness? And are the systems in place to rescue you ready for peak season? In a tick, you're going to hear from someone who's led search and rescue teams, as well as someone researching the way we behave when we're lost in the wilderness. But first, Dr. Joe Kippax is an emergency doctor and the 2026 Tasmanian Australian of the Year. He was part of a specialist team who rescued a whitewater rafter trapped in rapids on Tasmania's Franklin River. Joe, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning.
Joe, you've told this Franklin River rescue story probably a million times now, but would you mind just giving us a little recap?
I'm going to try and sort of condense about 24 hours into about 3 minutes. Look, there was a Lithuanian group, very experienced bunch of guys, and they were doing the Franklin River November last year, and they had a really unexpected mishap. Their leader, Valdas, slipped and fell while scouting the bank of the river. They were trying to get their boats and equipment through a particularly difficult rapid called the Coruscates Rapid, and he slipped and fell, and really unexpectedly, unbelievably, he got his knee really firmly wedged between two enormous boulders with a lot of water sort of flowing onto him and forcing him in that position. So then there was just this enormous and escalating rescue effort that sort of started off small but snowballed into, you know, one of the biggest rescue efforts ever seen in Tasmania. And there were immense efforts overnight to try and get Valdas out of that situation using heavy lifting equipment and hydraulic presses and pulley systems. All of that failed, and he was getting weaker and weaker. He was getting colder, and it was pretty clear he wasn't going to survive much longer where he was. And so it boiled down to the only option being an amputation of his leg to get him out, which that was only the beginnings of his problems, because when someone's in the water and very hypothermic, then it's quite likely they're going to deteriorate. And as he expected, as soon as Valdas was extricated from his trapped position, he had a cardiac arrest. And so then there was the business of trying to resuscitate somebody and provide continuous CPR while trying to fly them out of there, winch them out of there, and then fly them to hospital. So it was an enormous undertaking. And, you know, such an amazing result that he survived and done very well.
I mean, we can talk about this knowing in retrospect that he survived, you did an amazing job, you're Tasmanian of the Year now, like, congratulations. But in that moment, what are you feeling?
In that absolute moment? Well, it's a very focused moment. Mm. We, I mean, it's not completely out of the blue. It's a very, very rare procedure, amputation, but it is something that we train for, and prepare for and have the equipment for. So it's definitely part of the armamentarium of resuscitation and extrication. So most of it's of frantically thinking back to the training experiences you've had, and then trying to modify that for the situation you're in. And of course, this situation was different in that it was underwater. You couldn't see what was happening. It was a very awkward stance, with a very, very sick person who we knew was going to get worse as soon as he was extricated. So it was lots of challenging little elements to it, but mostly you're thinking what next and what could happen next and what I'm going to do if that happens.
Mm. How many people are involved in a rescue operation like this?
Huge number of people. There's a huge number of people involved, literally sort of probably something like 60 or 80 people altogether. And on the ground, there was probably about just a bit under a dozen people at varying stages. Everyone's doing sort of a crucial role. You've got the flight crews and pilots and engineers and refuelers sort of keeping the machines going. There's an immense amount of logistical organisation in the background to keep all of those supplies flowing, and the coordination. And on the ground, you've got different agencies working together. You've got Tasmanian Police, you've got Ambulance Tasmania, you've got the AMSA aircraft up in the air, you've got the Whitewater Rescue Team. So there's lots of different teams working together and lots of individuals working together. So it becomes a very big thing quite quickly and a very complicated undertaking quite quickly.
And you're in a really remote area. You're in a place that is by nature dangerous, because the reason you're there is because someone has already got into trouble. You put yourself in harm's way to help extract someone else. How are you or the dispatchers weighing that risk?
Look, I think that's a really good point. I think, when you say it's risky, I think there's an immense amount of effort and thought and planning that goes into making it as safe as absolutely possible. And that's always, the safety of the rescuers has always been weighed up against, the likelihood of success. And so everyone's actually going to a lot of effort to make it as safe as possible. And really, when things become unsafe, that's really a failure of planning. Usually that's when something unexpected happens. So, I guess I'd argue that really with a well-trained team, the absolute danger is probably overstated.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting at is the fact that we go out, if you're an outdoorsy person, part of the attraction of going out is a little bit of the danger. It's a little bit of the risk and pushing yourself to a limit. If you've had to go out to rescue someone, it means that someone, somewhere, something has gone wrong along the lines there. And some people, not everyone, certainly not Valdis and his team as very experienced rafters, but sometimes the reason that people like you are being called out is because people have gone out underprepared.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the beauty of the wilderness, isn't it? Is the unexpected nature of things. We certainly encourage people to be as prepared as they possibly can and as informed as they possibly can. But, sometimes things go wrong, as is the case in this particular rescue. We certainly knew that with this particular team, they're well-equipped. They had the communication gear to call for help. They tried to mount a rescue themselves, but quite quickly they worked out that wasn't going to be effective, and they called for help. So, hats off to that team for doing all the right things along the way.
Absolutely. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Dr. Joe Kupax. He's an emergency doctor, the 2026 Tasmanian Australian of the Year, and he's the doctor who performed the amputation that you may have heard of on a Lithuanian whitewater rafter last year, an incredibly difficult, complex rescue attempt. Because we are talking about heading out for summer. The numbers of people heading outdoors is increasing. We love to see it. Get out there and enjoy nature, but with it comes some risks. Jennifer in Canberra says, please tell listeners they should always take a whistle. When you're lost, it's easier to blow than to keep shouting. Make sure someone knows where you're going and your expected return. Another text says, my wife and I met a French tourist who was about to go on a hike near Bobbin Head in the Aussie summer of 2010. She didn't have a large water bottle or a hat. We gave her a brim hat, a water bottle, as we went kayaking. We shared details before she set off. It wasn't until the next day she messaged us with photos of her in a rescue chopper as she'd gotten lost and dehydrated in the Aussie bush. This person finishes by saying, incredible that people go hiking without any preparation. Well, also with me here is Dr. Jim Whitehead. He led the search and rescue team with Queensland Police for 17 years, and now he trains search and rescue coordinators across the country. And Crystal Dacey, a PhD candidate, looking into the way we behave when we're lost in the wilderness. Jim, I might start with you. Just step me through the process. If you're lost, but you have mobile reception and you call 000, what happens on the other end of that call?
Generally, if you have mobile reception, then the 000 caller can actually identify where you are through a GPS on your telephone, and they can activate or send it to the police, because the police are responsible for all land search within Australia, and then we can initiate a search with the resources that are closest to the incident.
And then if you don't know where you are, how do you communicate what you need?
Well, basically, it's a little bit of situational awareness. And when you go bushwalking or other outdoor activities, you really have to be aware of the environment you're in and understand where you're going, how to get there, the difficulties, the time it will take to do that, and that sort of stuff. But I did hear before that one of the biggest things you should do is tell someone responsible what you intend to do and when you intend to come back. That way, if you don't make it back, then the alarm can be raised for you.
So that's if you can call 000. If you've got a personal locator beacon, is it a different process with search and rescue?
Absolutely. A locator beacon actually activates or talks to a satellite. There's a constellation of 32 search and rescue satellites around the Earth there. And a beacon, once you turn the beacon on, it will identify where you are down to within 50 to 100 metres. And that call goes to the Australian Maritime Safety Authority in Canberra, and then they will send it to the appropriate authority to mount a rescue. So we actually have a very good idea where you are. The trouble with beacons of all sorts is it doesn't actually tell us what the problem is. It just tells us that there is a problem and here is where the problem is.
Crystal, you're researching something called lost person behaviour. What is this?
Hi, Tegan. So when a person is lost, they tend to exhibit some kind of statistically significant behaviour. So there's lots of different things that we can see that lost people do. And this has been all over the world. There's a guy out there, Dr. Robert Kester. He has founded this, and Jim has also worked on this for the Australian context. And it's just going, looking at past events, lost events, and finding consistencies amongst the behaviour of these lost people. So this is things like route travelling. So that's when a lost person, when they figure out that they're lost, they'll go back on the route they came, or they'll find a path and go directly on that path. There's also direction following. So if you're aware of where you need to go, what cardinal direction, you might go ahead in that direction until you find something significant, something familiar. Mm. There's also things like view enhancing, where you'll travel up a hill and try and find something familiar, or try and orientate yourself to the mountain, or try and find something familiar. And then, of course, the staying put, where a person will realise they're lost and they'll just stay where they are and wait for rescue.
And so how do you override that part of your brain if you're trying to make a decision when you are out and lost?
So my research looks more specifically, rather than the lost person behaviour that's currently used in search and rescue, is more activity based. So if you're a hiker, you're likely to do this. If you're a hunter, you're likely to do this. Whereas my research looks more into demographics. So say if you're a person with a lot of hiking experience, you're more likely to travel off track. Some may think that you're less likely to get lost, but, when taking into account the fact you are traveling off track, there's higher risk in that. That can lead to getting lost. I also look at the age of people. So older people tend to spend more time in national parks, but they are less likely to get lost. And that's also comes down to risk-taking behaviour. So there's lots of different instances of different people doing different things. And, you know, it's hard to put a blanket over everyone and say this is what everyone's going to do when they're lost. But there are some consistencies in different demographic factors that we can find.
Jim, just listening to that, I'm thinking about the fact that mobile coverage is so much more consistent and reliable than it used to be. People maybe, there's better technology around personal locator beacons and that sort of thing. Do you think it's changed the way people navigate outdoors and how far they push themselves?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I feel, and I think if we did studies on it, we'd probably confirm it, that with the advent of more handheld devices, mobile telephones, GPSs, beacons, and with the advent of far better equipment, as in motor vehicles and that sort of stuff, I think we tend to do a little bit more now than we would have done in the past, and it probably gives us somewhat of a false sense of security that I have all the devices so I can do something that I wouldn't have done, say, a decade ago. So I think in some cases it puts people in more trouble than they thought they would be in. But in other cases, it probably actually saves them, and we probably never know about those ones. But on the whole, I think it gives people a little bit of Dutch courage and allows them to experience some of that more thrills of the risks involved in travelling in a great country.
Here on the ABC Radio National, you're listening to Life Matters. You're hearing the voice of Dr. Jim Whitehead. He's trained search and rescue coordinators across the country now. I'm also speaking with Crystal Dacey, a PhD candidate looking into the way we behave when we're lost in the wilderness, and Dr. Joe Kippax, an emergency doctor, 2026 Tasmanian Australian of the Year, involved in pretty hectic outdoor rescues. A couple of stories on the text line that are striking a little bit of fear into my heart. One person said, I camped alone on the edge of a remote forest in Sweden. Decided to do a quick 1 kilometre nature trail before dark. At one point, I somehow joined a long trail and near dark contemplated staying the night in a dark hut. Then retraced my steps and finally got back to the car, very shaken. Quickly made a hot meal and went to bed. I'm much more careful everywhere now. Another person says, we ended up spending a night out in Canungra after the old walk out of a canyon had been overgrown. We had maps, personal locator beacons, and prepared to spend a night and backtrack and find a different way out the next day. Used the PLB to let family know we would be out for the night. Their response was along the lines of, have fun. However, the campsite people called rescue on us when we didn't return at the end of the day. When we made our way out the next day, we had a helicopter over our heads 20 minutes from the car park full of rescue, etc. Unnecessary in this case, but can understand why campers raised alarms. And Chris says the rescue and medical expenses cost the taxpayers of Tasmania $1 squillion. Chris says international rafters, etc., should have appropriate travel insurance. Jim, who pays for this sort of search and rescue apparatus?
Anywhere in Australia, if the search and rescue system is activated, it's a zero cost to the person who's in trouble. It's generally the taxpayer who foots the bill for almost everything. Some groups such as the SES, they're volunteers, so they give their time willingly, but you know, to use a rescue helicopter, to use a rescue vessel, all costs money, and generally it's all paid for by the taxpayer, ultimately, through levies or through donations or through individual government agencies that provide the service.
Joe, have you seen an increase in the number of people needing to be rescued in Tassie?
Yes, I think we have been seeing an increase. We certainly see a seasonal increase over the summer months when there's much more people sort of enjoying the outdoors. Gradually over time, there has been an increase. There probably has been a change in people's threshold for calling for help. You know, it's a complicated issue. We certainly don't want to discourage people from calling for help. And, you know, we've seen some bad outcomes with people who haven't activated the PLB and have, you know, there's been bad outcomes because of it.
Mm. When you say there's been a change in the threshold, do you mean people are less likely to want to call or more likely?
We get the impression some people are more likely to call. We've certainly had cases where people have been well outside of the comfort zone. Perhaps they've been less experienced, we think there's a phenomenon of people getting onto relatively difficult tracks and areas, perhaps of being influenced by what they're seeing online. And I guess if they're seeing pictures of people on a sunny day with minimal equipment, then there's a temptation to think, well, if they can do it, I can do it.
So is social media driving this rise in people heading out into the wild underprepared, do you think?
Oh, look, it's difficult to say that with certainty, but yeah, I think there's a suspicion that's part of the picture, yes.
Crystal, what kind of information would you like to be sort of seeing people receiving before they head outdoors to help them be prepared for how to help themselves if they get into trouble?
I think one of the main things is something that Jim touched on with the mobile phone usage and the way that people nowadays will just go out there because they have their mobile phone, because they have the route plan. And yes, a working mobile phone does decrease the time that a person is lost, but there's also a lot of issues that come with mobile phones in the sense that you go out, you've left it on, you're out for like 6 hours and your phone goes dead and then you're in trouble. There's a lot of research around the spatial cognition and navigation area looking at the fact that young people especially are just losing navigation ability because they just rely on their phones and they'll just blindly follow where their phones are telling them to go. Mm. So when we have that ability, that's great. And, you know, that can get people out of bad situations. But if you lose that ability because your phone goes dead or you lose your phone is broken, then that can cause a lot of problems. So, you know, definitely if we could all go back to the old school of being able to use a map and a compass and knowing our cardinal directions and where the sun rises and sunsets, I think that that would be a really good benefit for not only preventing these types of incidents or reducing these types of incidents, but also, you know, in our day-to-day navigation, even around towns and cities and driving and things.
Joe, what do you wish people knew before they headed outside?
Oh, look, I think we can do a lot with the amount of information that's available. You know, there's a huge amount of information out there, but it's often quite scattered. I'd love to see, you know, greater facility for pulling together all the information, the track notes and the up-to-date weather forecast and perhaps recent track conditions and, you know, advice on what to take, you know, all in a sort of an accessible format. The information's out there, but it's often scattered all over the place and it's hard to access.
Jim, you train search and rescue coordinators, but I wonder whether sometimes you wish you could just train the general public as well. What kind of education do you think we should have out there?
I would tell people to do some research on what the activity is that they want to do, research the bushwalking track, talk to national park rangers, talk to the people who are near the track. But the biggest thing I would encourage people to do is buy themselves the beacon, a PLB, register it. That way you can log a trip intention on the AMSA website. Also tell someone responsible where you're going to and when you expect to be back. And the greatest cause of you know, personal stress, I suppose, is lack of water in Australia. So take water with you. So if you do those three things, you probably limit the chances of you getting yourself into trouble.
Good advice, Jim, Joe, Crystal. Thank you all so much for joining me today. Dr. Jim Whitehead trains search and rescue coordinators across the country. Crystal Dacey is a PhD candidate looking into the way we behave when we are lost in the wilderness. And Dr. Joe Kippax is an emergency doctor, the 2026 Tasmanian Australian of the Year, which was awarded for his role as part of a specialist team that rescued a whitewater rafter trapped in rapids on Tasmania's Franklin River. And Jim mentioned AMSA before. That stands for the Australian Maritime Safety Authority, the national body for coordinating search and rescue like this. And thank you for your texts. One person says, I drove around logging roads in northern New South Wales, lost for so many hours in the 90s with some friends. We thought we would run out of fuel and never be found. Locator beacons and mobiles are game changers. Another, family adventure in Japan with my analog illiterate parents. Lost mum to closing train doors. Spent 4 hours looking for her, coordinating with local train staff and the Australian embassy. She found her way back to the station. We took the next train to the next stop. Assumed she would get off at the next stop. She made her way back. We underestimated her ability to find her way back. Wild experience. We now travel with air trackers, which just goes to show you can get lost in cities as well as in the wilderness. Regardless, have a plan with the people that you're with and that you love. And if you were inspired by Dr. Joe Kippax's story, the program Australian Story actually did an incredible piece on him and the rescue in the Franklin River. You can find that on ABC iView, but not yet. Stay with Life Matters here on ABC Radio National, because coming up, I want to know, what's your city's dress code?
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration.
I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
It's quite incredible.
Dear Jane, on The Book Show, Mondays at 10 on ABC Radio National, or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
The Christmas party invite says smart casual, but what does that mean when it's 35 degrees and there are storms on the way? And why are thongs acceptable in a Queensland office setting, but you would never catch anyone in Sydney with their toes out at work? There's no doubt our weather and our cultural trends influence what we wear, but how much personal freedom do we really have when we're getting dressed? Alex Haslam, a professor of social and organisational psychology at the University of Queensland. Alex, welcome to Life Matters.
Great to be here, Tegan, yeah.
Do dress standards still exist? It feels like you can wear a lot more chill stuff than you used to be able to.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer to that question is absolutely. I mean, dress is all about norms and standards and sort of values and identity, and it's all about projecting yourself onto the world. So as long as we dress, there'll always be standards. But of course, standards can also be violated in particular ways, but they're always done with reference to an understanding that we kind of share about what's appropriate and what constitutes a violation. But as you indicated in your opening comments, that these things change and they're negotiable and they vary from group to group and place to place.
Yeah, Australian culture likes to think of itself as being maybe a little bit more laid back than, say, Europe, where we, the UK. Does that play out in how we dress?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I sometimes joke I moved to Australia because I didn't like wearing a tie. You know, like, so, and that's another reason why I became an academic. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, but again, the informal can mean lots of different things, and I think it doesn't mean we don't dress up and we don't kind of do informality. So the interesting thing about those things is the ways in which they're shared, and even in groups that have, you know, on the face of it, very limited kind of rules, they're actually, when you observe them in an anthropological or psychological sense, they're often quite bounded, and there are things that you can't do. For example, if you're in a group that likes to kind of like be liberal in their dress, well, if you dress formally, that will be seen as some kind of statement of some sort. And so, yeah, that's those kind of dynamics play out, you know, on a daily basis. And as again, as you alluded to at the start of the talk, they can sometimes really come to the fore in moments where these things suddenly seem to be more negotiable, like the festive season, where you suddenly have to really think about them. What does it mean to interpret this particular set of rules that this person has handed down in this particular context, or the guidelines?
That's the thing I'm thinking about. This time of year, it's often parties, Christmas parties, lots of people get married in the summer, but it's also this time of year where our weather can be so horrible to anyone who wants to wear anything that covers their arms or legs. We sort of have this push and pull between what we usually would have interpreted as a formal dress code and the nature of our climate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you put it very clearly. I mean, I think that there's this utility aspect to clothing, like what's the weather going to be like today? But again, how am I going to be these different, or, you know, how am I going to get some sort of constancy in what I'm trying to achieve? And I think particular kind of events like weddings bring, and, you know, and maybe form meetings in office or something, bring those things to fore where, you know, oh, I'm going to have to get there through the rain. So you're going to have to negotiate all of those things. One thing I think we do often in those situations where there's sort of relatively sort of high degree of uncertainty is talk about them amongst ourselves. So work out, like, how are you going to solve this problem? And I think that's also a way of dealing with the uncertainty about, like, will I look out of place, or will it be acceptable if I don't this? So I think, you know, for people looking for advice, I mean, I think that's pretty, it's just ask someone else, like, what, who's going, who think has more status within the group or whatever it is. And of course we do that all the time, and we check, do you know, what do I look like in this, or is this the right thing, or should I wear these things tomorrow? These are conversations we have all the time.
I got an invite to an event a little while ago, and it said formal on the dress code. And then the day before the event, they sent out an email being like, if you want to wear a suit, you don't have to wear like a black tie, and women can wear knee-length dresses if you want, which maybe for some people was freeing. But the conversations I was having with my fellow attendees was, what a shame. Like, you don't often get a chance to really go all out I live in Brisbane, and it was sort of felt like it was going to be a fun excuse to really dress up, and that was sort of taken away from us.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, again, I think the key point there is actually, aside from the fact that it causes, can cause anxiety, we like opportunities to kind of dress up. And that's part of what makes events of like weddings, for example, special, is the fact you prepare for them and so on. And maybe you act out a different version of yourself in collaboration with, you know, friends and acquaintances. So, I think that's right. I think it's a peculiar form of sort of identity performance that you see in those situations. And as you say, that particular story is a kind of like, that was a bit of a blow, because I just have to be normal old me. You know, well, I can do that 364 days a year. So how about on this one day I get to do something a bit special? And I think we do look forward to those events. Graduations are another kind of thing, of the same sort of thing. If they said, well, come in thongs and a t-shirt to graduation, I think it would lose a certain amount of it, not only sort of gravitas, but also the idea of it as a sort of, as a special sort of occasion, and as something that, you know, is going to be memorable in a particular way. So I think we also, you know, those events as a kind of focus for future memories is critical. So we dress up and we take more photographs precisely so we have a recollection of this version of ourselves that we can share when necessary.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Professor Alex Haslam from the University of Queensland about dress codes. Alex, there was a recent thing in the US where the government launched a new campaign around air travel, and one of the key issues was dressing with respect. And the Transportation Secretary, Sean Duffy, was saying, let's try not to wear slippers and pyjamas as we come to the airport. Is it respectful of other people to be dressed in a certain way when we go out?
I think that's, you know, really that, you know, what is respect and what counts as respectful or being disrespectful, I think is very, I mean, I've seen, I don't know, I'm sure everybody's seen like people in onesies on planes and so on. I mean, I think, okay. You know, like, but I, again, I think those guidelines are interpreted with a huge amount of latitude, and again, I think that they're often not just about the clothing, but the demeanor of the person. Like, you know, so are you wearing this to upset us, or is this just you being you? You know, so I think I feel sympathy for the people who are going to have to interpret those rules when someone gets on a plane in, you know, thongs or whatever it is, or a t-shirt or something, or they haven't got a collar. I mean, but again, I always think like there's lots of places actually around the place which have those guidelines. I don't think I've ever seen anybody ever enforce them, you know, whether it's a golf club or whatever it might be, or even, you know, you go to a nice bar and it says this, that, and the other. I mean, I think people sort of orient to them. But again, I think it would be rather exceptional for people to actually enforce them in any way. They're meant to be, I think, sort of proactive and give you a sense of like what you're meant to be doing in the place. But again, I think on planes, you know, the question like, well, do I get changed into pajamas and so on? I mean, I think sometimes you don't want to be the first person to do that, right? So I think, again, we look around to others to a guide of like what sense, to get a sense of what's appropriate. And again, in those situations where these things are fluid, or like we haven't been there before, we're much more likely to do that, I think. But again, those events where we're authorized to dress up differently, you know, whatever that might be, as fancy dress or as zombies or anything like that, are things that we kind of enjoy and celebrate. And again, that's sort of part of being human, is using dress in these collectively creative ways. That's what fashion is, isn't it? I mean, fashion is the ability to cultivate a new sense of dress that projects new identities onto the world.
So on the text line, someone's put in a pretty spicy question. Are these sorts of dress codes a sort of caste system, a different lingo? What do you reckon, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're doing all that sort of stuff. They're projecting hierarchies and in-groups and out-groups and all those types of things. And I think groups also routinely sort of change their dress codes subtly to exclude particular people, you know, Johnny-come-latelys or whatever it might be, so that we can be we, and we can have this sort of tight sense of us, and we can exclude those other people who we don't want to be part of us. And that can be both kind of horizontal and vertical, if you like, in the sense of it's like, We're going to differentiate ourselves from people who we perceive to be inferior to us. But just groups who are perhaps a little bit too similar to us, well, it's important for us to get some sort of distinctiveness into who we are. So we're going to veer off in this alternative direction. But I think those things are going on all the time. And of course, they're realized formally in different cultures in different kinds of ways and have been, forever and a day.
I asked you to tell me what the dress code is in your city, and I'm very much enjoying what you're writing to me. Chris says, I went to the city in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago and felt like I was in a film noir. Everyone seemed to be dressed in grey, black, navy and beige. The CBD in Melbourne seems like a dark place at the moment. Is that the fashion nowadays? To which I would say, Chris, I think Melbourne's been wearing black since before black was invented. Another says, we live in a small rural town where no one wears shoes unless they absolutely have to. Smart casual is wearing more than stubby shorts. My husband wears shorts all year round, where I don't like wearing shorts at all. Another says, many years ago, I moved to the Gold Coast and was invited to a party. It was to be formal. I asked what sort of clothes I should wear, and they said, well, the boys will be wearing shoes. So that gives you a sense of formal there. Alex, in general, is overdressing better than underdressing? Should we always be wearing shoes?
I think your call is probably right there. I think it depends on the context. Sometimes shoes can be being overdressed, but I think the beauty of clothing and more generally apparel is there are rules, but there are no rules and these things. So should you be I think, in the scheme of things, you want to be somewhere in the middle. Or you want a sort of Goldilocks kind of experience, but sometimes you want to overdress and sometimes you maybe the opposite. So I think these things change a lot with context. They change hugely as a function of the groups that you're in, but also what you're trying to do in relation to those groups. Like, are you trying to lead them in some way, take them in some new direction? Iconoclastic or what, all that sort of stuff. But before coming on this program, I was thinking what sort of, if you were going to ask me what advice I should give anybody, I think it's almost impossible to give people advice about clothing that has, because you can pretty much always think about the opposite, the context in which to doing the opposite would make more sense. What you can do, I just think, is observe really interesting regularities and kind of points of tension that we all experience in clothing, where we suddenly have realized we have a decision to make and it will have particular implications. A good example is going for a job interview where you think, okay, they don't know me, I don't know them. Obviously, how I dress is going to be pretty important. So, what kind of jewelry am I going to wear, or am I going to wear a suit, and all this sort of stuff, and those points really bring these various issues we're discussing into focus, and we have to sort of make a decision about who we are going to be or who present as and what kind of relationship we want to forge or signal with the people that we're going to be interacting with.
Here on the text line, Lisa says, I think it's a mark of disrespect for people, institutions or businesses when the dress is not considered. What a dull life to wear dress down most times rather than dress up sometimes. Another says, Janet says, my sister-in-law wore shorts to my sit-down dinner. We had a giggle when she continually stuck to her leather chair. And another person decreeing, thongs belong at the beach or near water. Nowhere else are they acceptable footwear. I will pass that message directly on to Life Matters executive producer Lachlan McIntosh. She loves wearing thongs to work. Alex, thank you so much for joining me.
Great. It's great to talk to you. Yeah.
Alex Haslam is a professor of social and organisational psychology at the University of Queensland. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. And coming up next, human-made used to be a given, but in a world of AI, it's now become a marketing tool.
New from ABC Books. The young mother arrived at Port Adelaide in 1844.
In the trunk were European grapevine cuttings that she planted.
Her story is the story of the Australian wine industry itself.
Winemaking in Australia had been dominated by men ever since vines arrived with the first fleet, but Mary Penfold had broken the mould.
Mary Penfold by best-selling author Grant Lee Keyser. Book and audiobook available in bookshops and online.
So yesterday we spoke about AI music and songs generated by bots being consumed by real life people. And a lot of you texted in with some really strong thoughts on AI generated art. So we are continuing this conversation today. I want to talk about the backlash against AI generated ads. H&M and Guess, clothing retailers, have been busted using AI in their ads. And now other brands are using the audience's dissatisfaction to their advantage. Heineken, Polaroid, and Cadbury are all boasting that their campaigns are human-made. So has AI uptake already reached a fever pitch, and will we now start to see more pushback? And why is one of the first signs companies looking to make a buck? I'm joined by Dr. Paul Harrison, Head of Consumer Behaviour at Deakin University. We chat fortnightly. We call our chat Buyer Beware. Paul, welcome back to Life Matters.
Thanks so much, Tegan.
Why do we care if an ad is AI generated?
Look, I think one of the reasons is because we're human. And to some degree, what ends up happening is that even though people might go advertising, it's just about selling stuff, there is a creative underpinning to that. And creativity, and based on, you know, what you were talking about yesterday as well with Benz and Emery, was that creativity comes from experience and emotion and memory and struggle and irony. And even though advertising is ultimately trying to sell us something, it comes from that place. So to some degree, it actually, we do feel a little bit, uncomfortable about the idea that a machine is telling us how to experience an emotion. And people have seen ads that actually have an emotional resonance. And I think that's what's really important when we start to feel like, to some degree, the creative process is being taken out of human hands.
There's definitely ads that evoke an emotional response. Like, that's actually a really big button that they push. It's amazing that something that's only 30 seconds long can make you cry. Maybe that's just me. Maybe there's a feeling of being even more manipulated if that's coming from a machine and not another human being.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to some degree, when a lot of the research kind of says when people are told that it's made by technology, that they feel a little bit tricked or duped or a bit stupid. It kind of goes to the base of this idea of this sense of competence, this idea of being replaced, this idea that we need to save face. And saving face is a really, really critical part of what it means to be human, because to some degree, people have this, I guess, this internal picture of themselves, of who they think they are and who they want to be. And we've talked about this before. And then when something like a technology threatens that, what to some degree happens is that they go, okay, so the person that I thought I was isn't the person that I am. I can't pick up these things. And so we become very uncomfortable and we feel like we're going to be replaced. We feel like to some degree that, you know, that this technology is performing a task that we thought was uniquely human. And so it becomes a very dissonant experience for a lot of people. And I think that's part of what's going on then when we find out that something was AI or not AI, we feel a little bit tricked and we feel this emotional response as much as anything else.
So that was basically what Emery's research. We spoke to Emery Schubert yesterday about, he's a music psychologist, about the emotional response we have to music and the fact that people will hear a piece of music and like it until they find out that it's AI and then they say, oh no, I don't like it. So is it partly maybe because it's new? Like, do you think that once AI is more ingrained in just our day-to-day that we'll feel less of that loss of face?
I think it will become, I mean, to some degree, and this is again, you know, lots of people are saying this, we've been using AI for 30 years or so. It's just what's emerged in the last 2 or 3 years is a more consumer-based product. So ChatGPT and those different kind of large language models, that what they're doing is that they're giving access to people to be able to create, to some degree, you know, artworks and music and all sorts of things. I think the mistake and the concern that we have here is that ultimately any form of creative endeavor, whether it's, you know, broadcasting, whether it's creating advertising, whether it's creating music, comes from people's experience of life. And to some degree, a technology can't really understand. What it can do is it becomes what we always kind of refer to it in education as a stochastic parrot, this idea that it's just repeating back to us what we've already considered and what we already understand. I had this really interesting experience when I was teaching in France earlier this year. And one of the things was I asked these undergraduate students to ask them to use one of these models to explain something complex that is a real really kind of key to French culture. And what they realized was that the model was basically translating the French into English, then looking at English ideas of culture, and then slowly kind of translating that mental model back to them. And this is the thing, is that there is a limitation on all of this type of technology, in that it's based predominantly around English culture to some degree, that it is based on things that can be digitized, and it is based on things that can be understood in some form of language. And we all know that language is limiting, whether it's when we listen to a piece of music, sometimes people will go, I don't know why it moves me, but like you were saying, I'm crying. Why am I crying? And we can't express that. And I think the creative process, even with advertising, even with an ad, sometimes we just go, why does this make me cry? You know, and it's much deeper than necessarily what a technology will ever be able to understand. It's, you know, to some degree, it's Plato's cave kind of thing. It's where it's chasing shadows rather than fully understanding what's going on outside that cave.
And like you say, if it's only based on a sliver of our culture and society, it's flattening our experience into just that one narrow band.
Yeah, exactly. And what ends up happening then is that it really doesn't give us any sense of serendipity. And I think a really important part of, you know, even living a full life is this idea of, oh, I didn't even expect that. Some of us, again, you know, will be watching something or reading something and will be taken off in a direction that we weren't expecting. And people will, a lot of my colleagues who work in the kind of artificial intelligence area, they say it will get better. But I think to be human is to step into the unknown and to kind of think and act without certainty sometimes, because often that's when we kind of have these moments of, I don't know, excitement and highs and lows. In a way, what we're doing when we use artificial intelligence, even with advertising, and I've seen this in advertising, is that it does flatten it. It basically looks at patterns and it says, this is what most people have responded to most of the time. And when we do modelling of human behaviour in the different areas that I work in, often our models kind of miss out on around 35% of what actually influences people's behavior, because to some degree we don't really know what it is to be human. And I think that's the beauty of trying to understand what works and what doesn't.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Paul Harrison for our regular chat, Buyer Beware, all about the way we buy and the way we're marketed to. Talking about AI in advertising, Lisa says, AI might have its advantages in some fields, but I'm already fed up with it intruding on my everyday life. When I'm doing a task on screen, it pops up regularly, asking me questions, breaking my concentration. I prefer to seek information rather than an algorithm trying to preempt my needs. And Greg says, AI-generated ads or production crew-generated ads, what's the difference? Both are manipulative. Paul, we had a lot of furor a decade or two ago over Photoshop use in ads. Is this sort of just an extension of the same gripe?
Yeah, pretty much so. And, you know, to some degree, we're still having the arguments over Photoshop and the use of Photoshop and manipulating people. So I don't think we've resolved that. And maybe we should look back and go, okay, so if we're still struggling with something like Photoshop manipulating how people look, then maybe this is something we need to be thinking about. And, you know, for a lot of it, people still can't tell the difference. You know, people will say, like, this is not a real human body, but our emotional response is to the image, to what we're seeing, and we think that is representative of particular people. And it's exactly right. You know, of course, marketing and artists and everything, they do manipulate us. But I think there's a bigger question here, is not necessarily how we use AI, but why do we actually need to use it? And why do we need to use technology? Because ultimately, a technology is meant to, I guess, contribute to the human condition. And to some degree, what this is doing is it's kind of supporting itself. And we're in this system now where it basically rewards productivity and efficiency rather than curiosity. And so what ends up happening is that any new technology that comes along, we kind of jump on it because it promises efficiency. But we need to be stopping and slowing down and saying, but how is this helping us to live better lives? And I think that's what's missing, this idea that we just get so excited about saving money and making money that we forget about, ultimately, why are we using this thing? And even in universities, we're not asking those questions. And I think it does need to be asked. I think we need to, from the moment kids start I guess, learning, they need to be asking, well, why are we using this? What's the purpose of this? What is the use of this technology?
Rob on the text line says, it's confronting to have machines take over elements that we hold dearly as human, like creativity and emotions. It leaves us questioning our collective value and place. That, to me, is the most jarring. Well, Paul, thanks as always for joining me. Paul Harrison, Head of Consumer Behaviour at Deakin University. He joins me fortnightly for our segment, Buyer Beware. Well, earlier in the show, you heard from Joe Kippax, who was an emergency doctor, 2026 Tasmanian Australian of the Year, part of a specialist team who rescued a whitewater rafter trapped in rapids on Tasmania's Franklin River, because we were talking about preparing for adventuring, making sure that you're as prepared as possible so that hopefully you don't need rescuing by someone like Joe. But you've got to hear the story. It's an incredible tale. Here's Dr. Kippax on how it played out.
Look, there was a Lithuanian group, very experienced bunch of guys, and they were doing the Franklin River November last year, and they had a really unexpected mishap. Their leader, Valdas, slipped and fell while scouting the bank of the river. They were trying to get their boats and equipment through a particularly difficult rapid called the Coruscates Rapid, and he slipped and fell, and really unexpectedly, unbelievably, he got his knee really firmly wedged between two enormous boulders with a lot of water sort of flowing onto him and forcing him in that position. So then there was just this enormous and escalating rescue effort that sort of started off small but snowballed into, you know, one of the biggest rescue efforts ever seen in Tasmania. And there were immense efforts overnight to try and get Valdas out of that situation using, you know, heavy lifting equipment and hydraulic presses and pulley systems. All of that failed, and he was getting weaker and weaker. He was getting colder, and it was pretty clear he wasn't going to survive much longer where he was. And so it boiled down to the only option being an amputation of his leg to get him out, which that was only the beginnings of his problems, because when someone's in the water and very hypothermic, then it's quite likely they're going to deteriorate. And as he expected, as soon as Valdas was extricated from his trapped position, he had a cardiac arrest. And so then there was the business of trying to resuscitate somebody and provide continuous CPR while trying to fly them out of there, winch them out of there, and then fly them to hospital. So it was an enormous undertaking, and, you know, such an amazing result that he survived and done very well.
So that's Dr. Joe Kippax, an emergency doctor, part of the specialist team who rescued a whitewater rafter trapped in rapids on Tasmania's Franklin River. That was part of a much bigger chat about what happens when things go wrong in the wild. I very recommend you go back and listen to it. Go to the ABC Listen app, search for Life Matters, and you'll be able to listen to that later today. And if you're there, you should hit subscribe or hit follow so that you never miss an installment of Life Matters. And your texts have also been very illuminating today on the sorts of sticky spots you found yourself in the wild. One said, I did the Nudgee Wilderness Walk and got lost after the fire as the track was overgrowing. I spent 2 hours to go 600 metres to get back to where I was. I nearly set off my PLB, but after I'd had a moment to relax, I was okay. I did continue on. I saw the biggest snake I've ever seen in my life, but I don't know who was more frightened. Another says, there were three separate rescues in Kosciuszko National Park on Saturday the 15th, all close to the summit walk. Instead of the messaging of getting a PLB, number one should be get experience. Thank you so much for your texts on surviving in the wild. One person says, I'm a sea kayaker with lots of experience, but I scared myself one weekend paddling back from Moreton Island to Redcliffe on the mainland in Queensland. As I set off, the weather clouded over and rain started, completely obscuring my view of the coast I was heading for. The outgoing tide then swept me along through a shoal with large waves and almost out past Bribey Island to Caloundra. Eventually, the clouds cleared and I reoriented myself, but I gave myself a good scare. Charts and GPS are now standard equipment. We also spoke before on the show about dress code and what the dress code is in the town where you live. One person says, I live in Bowraville and it's very normal for locals to pop into the shops in PJs and a robe. The next town over, Maxville, you're the odd one out if you wear shoes to the shops. Another from Ruth says, there's a funny anecdote in Almost French, a book by Sarah Turnbull, when an Australian in Paris went out in her track pants to surprise her boyfriend with croissants. Her French boyfriend was horrified, saying the baker would have to bear looking at her dressed like that. And another says, people also dress by labels, sometimes to show status. Most formal dress codes can exclude poor people. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters, coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow on the show, we are talking housing and design with none other than Kevin McLeod from Grand Designs and mid-century design maven Tim Ross. We'll be talking about The Building That Moved You, how shows like Grand Designs shape our expectation of what a quote-unquote good home should look like, and yes, how Australia should tackle its housing crisis. That's Kevin McLeod and Tim Ross with me tomorrow on Life Matters. Catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.